Before we start, I want to thank, welcome everybody, of course. Nice to see everybody, and hope to, as we, session number 9 tonight, I believe, right? This is our 9th session on show. Eight. Next week will be number 9. We'll get the bar mitzvah soon. But it's, I want to thank the Hartmans, Rabbi Barry and Shoshana Hartman, for sponsoring this evening's yeshir in memory of their parents. I think Rabbi Hartman's going to say a few words in, about his parents very, very briefly. Really from two different worlds. So, Bakasha, Rabbi Hartman.
Yeah, just a short thing. My in-laws are emotions per Turner. My emotional were in the Vatican Yeshiva for World War II in Bialystok. He was, then he survived the war. And when the war broke out, he was now the Vatican Yeshiva in town of Pultusk, Poland. He escaped to Vilna, September 39, after Hitler to Poland. And then, based on Chaimezi, the Russians got him after Yugoslavia. He was in Siberia for 5 years. And because he was a Polish citizen, the Russia expelled him in 1945. And he eventually got roomed around. So he found a DP camp, married, came to America in the late 40s, grabbed by Nis Flappish. But in America was the Talmud of the Rav. Over maybe 25 more years, he sent to the Rav Shia Tuesday nights at Maria, and then to Yangizov, the West Side. Very close to the Rav in America. He called him his Rebbe and everything. So that was who he was. He was a very fine Ben Torah. We came in at that world when it stood the Rav. My parents were American born. Father's a soldier veteran in World War II, was almost 3 years in Europe, the Air Force. He was not a liberator, but after VJ Day, he was supposed to go to fight the Japanese. His whole division was sent into Germany. So because he spoke a fluent Yiddish, he translated for this letter, the survivors from Dachau concentration camp, he was translated for them. So that's what I mentioned there. And that was there. And so I want to thank you, Mark. You were very good yesterday in the Chazonish, just to mention good. And the talk yesterday was very good, the Chazonish. Very, very good, the Chazonish. So when you go up in Yeshiva, were the Chazonish, you know, but you were very, very good. So anyway, that's what, thank you, everybody, Mark, by Kelmuth, want to say and continue on the learning, Chazak.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Rabbi Hartman, for all your emails to me, which I've learned so much from. So thank you very much for that. Yes, the talk on the Chazon Ish, it was only 20 minutes, but then you had two others. That'll be on the Jewish National Library soon on their YouTube, if you're interested. Okay, let's get right to where we need to go. Again, I'm just going to go in my pile here, spend 15 minutes. We're going to talk a little bit more about mixed seating today. Rabbi Shudnow, I mean, separate seating also without mechitzas, Rabbi Shudnow emails me that as he understands it, when Lieberman came into the seminary, he kept to all the minhagim established by Ginsburg. So Ginsburg had already established a separate seating, no mechitza, so Lieberman didn't want to alter that. Eli Turco emails me, I've never been to the shul in Brussels. Maybe some of you have. He says that the shul in Brussels, where the Rav and the Chazan are very orthodox, women and men sit separately without a machitza. On the other hand, Eli, you also mentioned that they have a choir of non-Jews, which doesn't strike me as so orthodox. So that's probably a holdover from the olden days. Now, I want to show everyone something about...
Mark, when I was in Brussels...
Yeah.
We did not sit together. I was there a number of times over Shabbos, unfortunately. The non-Jewish choir is a compromise, and they never sing with the chazan. They only sing when the kohal is repeating words in the Shemona Esrei. So they're very careful about
that. No, but I'm saying is there separate seating? No machitza. That's what Eli says.
No, absolutely not.
Say... This was an issue, non-Jews in the choir. They had it in England, and it was a controversy. You can't actually point to anywhere in the Shulchan Aruch that says there's a problem with it, but it just pasnish. I mean, it's not, that's not what davening, to have non-Jews involved in the davening is really not so appropriate, I would think. By the way...
But the conservative agreed to take out the organ.
Yeah, so yeah, of course.
If they would bring in non-Jews to the choir.
Oh, okay. That's a compromise. Okay, I guess that's a good compromise. I will say as well, in terms of, I mentioned that some things, you know, you can't really point to the Shulchan Aruch, but you know they're wrong. Mechitza itself is not in the Shulchan Aruch. So that's an interesting thing. I want to give you an example to show you how this separate seating, mixed seating thing still remains in America as an important distinguishing mark between Orthodox and conservative. I was, let's see, where is it here? Hold on, I have it here. Maybe it's here. Hold on, I have it here, I think. Maybe I, here it is. Okay. So I was in the store Friday and I always get ice cream. I don't eat it, but my kids like it. So I found a new ice cream. I passed right by the Ben and Jerry's and there's this new ice cream called Hudsonville. I never heard of this. They gave him 2 shelves of all interesting ice cream. It was on sale. So of course, like what we do, the first thing we do, we look for Ashkacha. And I saw Ashkacha, which I didn't recognize. Here it is. It looked like, I wasn't sure what it is, but within 2 minutes, I figured I found out that it's Ashkacha of Michigan, Detroit. Look what they say in description describing themselves. It says, below is a list of companies who currently have a kosher certificate from the Metropolitan Kosher Council of Michigan. Mind you, we do not certify every product made by these companies, nor is every version of a product indicated under our supervision. Then it goes on to say, every consumer must be vigilant to make sure to only purchase items that have our symbol in the package or that of another reliable Orthodox kosher agency. Locally and elsewhere, there is a relatively new issue of conservative rabbis giving kosher certification. There is no distinguishing a conservative kosher symbol from an Orthodox. And aside from asking, there is no way to know if your supervising rabbi has a machitza in his shul or is Shomer Shabbos. So here you see they're giving the definition here of Orthodox is dafka that you have a machitza. By the way, I don't know if this is true about conservative rabbis getting kosher certification. I know of, I'm very interested in this, and I know of like one product, a little local product. You might have some like vegan type of rest or veggie restaurants to have, but in terms of packaged items, I haven't seen. A couple of weeks ago, we raised the issue of Lashon Hara. And where the person doesn't know you said it, and come Rosh Hashanah time, do you go and apologize? And then he'll say, you say, I spoke bad about you, but he didn't know about it. Now he knows about it, so you make him feel bad that you get forgiveness if he gives it to you, but he never knew about it. And I said that, as I recalled, there was a dispute between Rabbi Sol Salanter and the Chafetz Chaim, and a number of people pointed out that that's true. And that he didn't want to give a haskama to the sefer of the Chafetz Chaim. At the time, by the way, I said that the Aderis wrote a haskama to the Mishnah Berurah. It's not true. He wrote a haskama to the Likutei Halachos in Kudshim. Supposedly, Rav Kook, they say, wrote the haskama. But in terms of the larger issue, I have many notes on it. I was just off the cuff, though. I didn't have it at my hand. There's a very good discussion in this book, Parach Matei Aaron from Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Volume 1, page 187. He records this as a tradition that he heard from Rav Huttner, that when the Chafetz Chaim finished his work, Chafetz Chaim, he went to Rishon Salanter to get haskama, and the Rishon Salanter won't give him haskama because the Chafetz Chaim actually records this as halacha, which is from Rabbeinu Yona mentions it, that even if the person doesn't know about it, you need to apologize. And Rishon Salanter's attitude is, he doesn't care. It's you can't do that. The fact that Riona says it, he thinks that maybe Rabbi Yonah doesn't mean it, but he does say it. And there's other traditions that Rishon Salanter thought in these areas he was able to dispute with the Rishonim, who thought that as much. So you can look for that if you're interested, and many other sources as well. I spoke last class all about Rabbi Morris Adler, and I had something on my computer screen, and I can't believe I forgot it to mention it, so I'll show it to you now. We spoke all about Rabbi Morris Adler. I forgot to mention that Rabbi Morris Adler, it's famous. He was killed Shabbos morning during a bar mitzvah. This deranged congregant that he had been counseling gets up and shoots him and kills him. They even renamed the highway in front of the shul there, the Rabbi Morris Adler Highway. A whole book was written on this incident. Murder in the Synagogue. This is a play, for those who know, of T.S. Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral. It's you can read all about the event that it records, where King Henry said, "Well, no one rid me of this turbulent priest." And Thomas Becket, Thomas Becket, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and some knights decided that they would take care of him. So that's Murder of the Cathedral. Irene, after I mentioned T.S. Eliot last week, that's why I mentioned him. I said, I was talking about, if someone, a Holocaust denier at University of Scranton, wrote a good book on T.S. Eliot, I guess you could still read it, despite his problems of his evil nature of being a Holocaust denier. That's why I mentioned T.S. Eliot. So Irene emails me, Irene from England, that he also is a big anti-Semite, T.S. Eliot. And that's true. You can look it up. He's a bona fide anti-Semite, unfortunately. I was speaking about the Beis Midrash HaGadol last week, and Beis Midrash HaGadol in Detroit. And I couldn't remember the name of the rabbi. Here is his name. Charles Eliezer Hillel. I guess it's pronounced Calver or Carl. He was rabbi for 69 years in at this shul. Some 50 years as the rabbi and then 19 years as rabbi emeritus. And I said in the class that this was always an Orthodox shul, but it's really more complicated than that. I'm holding the whole doctoral dissertation written on him at the University of Denver. What happened was, obviously, with a name like Beis Midrash HaGadol, began Orthodox. Then he's hired in 1902 from the seminary, but he always regarded himself as Orthodox. And he referred to the shul as Orthodox, both Orthodox and traditional. And then when he becomes rabbi emeritus, they bring in another rabbi from the seminary and then another rabbi from the seminary, and the shul's going too far from the left. Rabbi Calver is not happy with it, and he still has much support. And they're able to prevail on the synagogue to join with the OU and only have an Orthodox rabbi. So I guess in the 50s, before it officially becomes Orthodox, although Rabbi Calver says that we are Orthodox, the rabbi was saying, no, we're conservative. That was a member of the United Synagogue. But then it officially becomes Orthodox. So you can read all about it in this very interesting doctoral dissertation. I bought it for the University of Scranton Library, and it's come in quite handy. A couple more minutes, two more minutes. Let me take this out here. Two more things I want to show you. Oh, well, first, thank you, Chaim, for sending me. I won't play it now in the interest of time, but anyone who wants, just Google rare video of Satmar Rebbe at a chuppah. You can see the Satmar Rebbe together with his entourage walking down the aisle. Like I said, how interesting that is. You know what? I'm going to hold off on the other things I have. I got one. I got 2 minutes. And this will then bring us up to date. I remember two classes ago, I spoke about the Rogatchover. I looked back at exactly the issue is that what the halacha, the Yerushalmi says that if you're in an Avel or in Tisha B'Av, Tisha B'Av is more lenient. If you, it's like an istinus. If you need Torah, you're allowed to study Torah. Now, this is not recorded in the Shulchan Aruch, and the Rogatchover never justified himself this way. He simply said, as I told you, that he's willing to be punished for learning Torah. So that's the source there. And finally, again, returning to this, what I showed you a few weeks ago, we spoke about the grave of the Rav Meir of Eisenstadt. We were wondering why his grave of all others. Actually, the article mentions what I think David Eisen referred to, that Stuart Eisenstadt is one of his descendants. So maybe that's the reason. I asked Rabbi Billet, and Rabbi Billet said he came in right to the commission, right before the Panim Eros event. So he has no clue, he says, why he was chosen. But he says that there's no money for this from the government. This is all done. They raise the money privately. So it's always descendants or things like that. Remember, we spoke about the Panim Eros. The reason I mentioned that is because he spoke about confessions, confessing your sins publicly. And I actually said that he's referring to Hasidim, maybe in that tshuva. You have to be proto-Hasidim, what they call pre-Beshtian Hasidim, because he dies in 1744. I'll end with our Dayan, who listens to the shiur. He sent me a tshuva, and he told me that this idea of confessing publicly actually created problems, because in some places, if there wasn't like an epidemic or problems like that, they wanted everyone to come in and confess their sins to find out what's going on, what's causing this. And he sent me a tshuva. I'll tell you where the tshuva is for those who want to look it up. It's in Tshuva Shaarei Deah of Rav Chaim Litvin, number 82, where it's similar to this, but during these after the Magefa, they're investigating as to what happened. It wasn't actually that the person confessed, but other people confessed, as it were, that this woman was committing adultery. And they bring her in, and they beat her till she. It's terrible stuff. You'll be embarrassed to read this. They beat her, getting her to confess, and they force the husband to. And she doesn't confess, by the way. And then they force the husband to divorce her, and that's the question. Is this a valid divorce? Because the husband agreed to divorce her because they were beating his wife, and it's. But all because of a plague, and they wanted to get to the bottom of it. Okay, my friends, let us continue. We are picking up right where we left off, and I feel that I need to respond to a comment that was left in the chat before we pick up again with Lieberman. The last comment, but we were already at the end. Rabbi Kelman was talking, so I texted back, you might recall, but I'll get to it next class. I was speaking about the driving tshuva that we spend so much time about. And I said that it was done to make things easier for the people, the congregants. So someone wrote in, that's not true. It's a mischaracterization. It was to retain the connection to those people who would not drive but could not walk. In other words, people who couldn't walk to shul, but they wouldn't drive. And this then gives them a hector that they can drive. I have to say that I completely reject the categorization of the person who wrote it in. People were already driving to shul. This was a way to soothe the consciences so people can come to shul and not feel guilty. Remember, these are people moving to the suburbs. They chose not to move to live near shul. It's not always so easy. You want to get a different house. They chose to move to the suburbs, and they chose to move far away from shul, and then they drive to shul. Rather than insisting that you have to live near the shul, instead a hector was given. The people already were going to drive to shul, that you can drive. It allows for them to come to shul and feel it's okay. And this is what I mean by making things easier. The people are choosing to move so they can't drive to shul. And what you do is you give them a tshuva, a halachic ruling that it's really okay. Let me tell you something else. It's not just me who says it. If you look in the book here, Ben Sion Boxer, this is the book Tradition and Change, Ben Sion Boxer's response to this, he says as follows. Many people find it difficult to reach a synagogue on the Sabbath unless they travel. And he says there's been much agitation in recent years demanding a change. But he notes that this element of the Sabbath halacha is being widely ignored already. And then he continues on page 307. He says, all these people who are driving to shul on Shabbos, quote, shall we then appease their attitude and declare the Sabbath halacha generally inoperative? He says, we're going to appease them. They choose dafka not to move to the shul, and we're going to appease them by telling them it's okay. Page 398, as a normal arrangement, a person who cares about religious life must endeavor to live accessibly close to a synagogue, and accessibly close means within walking distance. And then he says, in many cases, the dilemma is not altogether real. He says people who feel they must travel could and often do walk greater distances. That is, when they want to walk, they walk. But he says today, walking's disappeared and people just use their car for short distances. Then he says on page 399, there may be cases when a person can't live close to the shul. Let's say you're in an old nursing home. He says in those cases, that's when you should, consult with the rabbi. He thinks that given the choice between travel on the Sabbath or total denial of davening, then traveling is the less objectionable alternative. He doesn't speak about who's, if you're driving, being taken in a car. But don't think this is just a conservative approach. There are Orthodox poskim. Eretz Chemda ruled that in a case where someone is homebound, and can't get to shul, that you can have a non-Jew drive him to shul. You can, for more details, I know the head of Eretz Chemda is giving shiurim now. I think you can even ask the question in English, even though the shiur is in Hebrew. Their tshuva was, they said, in order not to get accustomed to this, do it three times, I believe, not four times a month. But this, and remember the stories of the Shabbos bus, where there was discussions of having Rabbi Jack Simcha Cohen. I mean, if there is a I think people are going to drive anyway, but the case in Eretz Chemda is where the person was homebound and have no religious life. After all, if a non-Jew takes you, it's a shvus, you can say a shvus min kol mitzvah. There's all sorts of things you can say. And then listen to what Rabbi Boxer says. There has been some expression on the part of our colleagues that we ought to remove the sense of guilt from those, you know, from those who are violating the Shabbos law. And he says this is an impossible demand. So I didn't invent it, what I said, that he says the Sabbath has always been an interference with the free movement of life. But there's a value to it. And on page 370 in the Tshuva by Rabbi Adler and the others, they say that in justifying this ruling, they say when attendance at services is made unreasonably difficult without the use of automobile, then such use shall not be regarded as being a violation of the Sabbath. So if attendance at services is made unreasonably difficult, then it's permissible to drive on Shabbos is not a violation. What does that mean, unreasonably difficult? The person chooses to buy a house 5 miles from shul? Yes, if you move 5 miles from shul, then you're not going to be able to walk to shul, but that's not unreasonably difficult. That's a person for their own convenience, in the sense that they prefer to live in that house versus this house. But people who value Shabbos know that sometimes you don't always get the house you want, but there are more important things than the exact house you want. So I stand by my categorization that this is all about making life easier, and by which I meant soothing the conscience, to use Rabbi Boxer's term. Let us now return to where we are. We ended last class by talking about the Chayrim against Mordechai Kaplan. This is going to be very important in the story with Lieberman. Wait till you see in a few minutes what Kaplan says about Lieberman in his diary. Now, this ceremony, in which they put, is a big ceremony in 1945 where they place Mordechai Kaplan in Chayrim, a ceremony with over 200 rabbis of the Igudas Rabbanim, as well as other onlookers and reporters. It took place at the hotel in New York called the McAlpin Hotel. Now, I did not know about this hotel, but of course, today you find everything online. Here's a picture of it. It still exists. It's not as a hotel, though. But very interesting is if you look at notable events, there's a few notable events. One of it is that Jackie Robinson, he was living there when he received the phone call from the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947. As it says, that would change America. Also, I found it interesting that if you're a New York area person, you know WMCA. That's MCA. That's a McAlpin Hotel. Well, I think one of you, or maybe I'll do it because anyone could add, notable events, this should be added to the Wikipedia entry. I think tonight I'll add it. If you don't know this, anyone could add anything you want to Wikipedia. So this is an important event in American Jewish history, covered by the New York Times and every other paper, that it took place there. I want to show you the article on Hapardes, so you get a sense. This is in Hapardes, 1945. They have a whole report here, right at the beginning of the issue. They talk about the second day of Rosh Chodesh Tammuz in 1945, there was a great asifa, a great gathering of Agudas Rabbanim because of the scandal of Dr. Mordechai Kaplan. He's a Macy's and Mediach. He's leading people astray from belief in God because he printed a new sitter to change the tefillahs. Especially, it says in his introduction, he chose this complete heretic, rejects all the 13 principles, the Torah Shebaal Peh, etc., etc. Hundreds of Rosh Yeshiva and rabbis and important Baal Batim came to this event, and they all said that this person, Mordechai Kaplan, he has to accept his punishment and it has to be made public that he has no share in Israel unless he repents. And it talks about how Rabbi Israel Rosenberg led off, and listen to this. He says, "We're here to raise a protest against Echad Conservativi rabbis, against one of the conservative rabbis who has a new sitter. And he says they are worse. These Rechtzer rabbis are worse than Reform rabbis because every religious Jew knows what a reformer is, that you have to separate from them. But the conservative rabbis, they dress themselves in a new Judaism, like, you know, being modern, but also they claim to be observant. And then it says after them, many Orthodox Jews will follow. Yehudim Charedim. In those days, in the 40s, the word Charedi didn't refer to Charedim, like we think of them, just Orthodox. And then Rabbi Rosenberg mentions that he published Haggadah of Pesach, which took out certain stories, and also Shavuot HaMascha al Goyim. It took out, pour out thy wrath on the nations. And he did this to kiss up to the nations of the world. What does the Hapardei say? What nations? These nations that stood by and watched while millions of Jews were killed in Majdanek and Auschwitz and Treblinka and Buchenwald and Dachau. He says more than 5 million Jews killed. At that time, the number they gave was 5 million. And the nations did nothing. So we're going to be concerned about, we're going to take away Shvo'ot HaMascha. Then it says that they declared this declaration. Everyone stood up. They said it to Hillel. They said that the God knows the ways of the righteous. The ways of the wicked will come to an end. And then they read out the Chayrem. And then it says here, Acharei HaSifa, after the gathering, Nisraf HaSidur, Ketin Sefer Torah, Savo Min, sorry, it's after the gathering, the Siddur was burnt, just like the Halacha, that if a Sefer Torah is written by a heretic, it is to be burnt. I want to come back to this point in a second. Now, let me just, here's the Nusach of the Chayrem. It says that this Mordechai Kaplan, he printed this terrible Siddur, and then it goes on that Huchat Pechad, it's been declared to put him in Chayrem, Windoso, Achrimo, Afdil, Mikal Yisrael, until he does tshuva. And then a complete Isser on his Siddur, and it goes on talking about how bad he is. And then at the end, this last paragraph, page 3, it talks about why we are putting him in Chayrim. What about all the Reform rabbis and their Sidurim? And again, they repeat the same thing, that there's a difference. The Reformers, they already, we know who the Reformers are. But Oso HaIsh, that's how they refer to him. That's the term used to refer to Jesus. Oso HaIsh, Dr. Kaplan, Hu B'toch B'nei Yisrael, he's among Israel. He says that he is like a Jew. He has a synagogue, etc. So in other words, people are being confused with someone like Kaplan. Kaplan wore tzitzis. So therefore, it's important to separate him. The last sentence, which I just read to you, before the Chayrim, then after stating the Chayrim, then the Siddur was burnt, that certainly reads like an official act. And if you look at all the writers who write about it, they all describe it that way. In this book, Jacob J. Schachter and Jeffrey Gurek, a modern heretic in the traditional community, Mordechai M. Kaplan, Orthodoxy in American Judaism, they write as follows. They quote Mel Skolt. Mel Skolt is the greatest Kaplan scholar. He's written a book on Kaplan and also published the diaries. He suggests, they quote him, he suggests that the act of book burning was unintentioned and not directed by the rabbinic leaders themselves, but all evidence points to the contrary. This was clearly an official act sanctioned by those assembled as a fitting and appropriate conclusion to a most serious and solemn deliberation. So both Gurek and Schachter say it's obvious, it's an official act. Zachary Silver is a rabbi, a conservative rabbi. He's the head of a school. I forget where now, but he wrote a wonderful essay when he was an undergrad that was published in American Jewish Archives on the excommunication of Kaplan. And you can see this online. He writes, Mel Skolt's biography of Kaplan mentions that the event occurred, but he does not believe that Agudas HaRabbanim burned the book as part of the formal ceremony. Rather, he says that the burning occurred incidentally at the back of the room. However, Agudas HaRabbanim's documents illustrate that it was a previously scripted formula. I'm going to have to email. I should have done this today. I'm going to email Mel Skolt and ask why he concluded. Mel Skolt's right. That's the whole point. He doesn't say why he's right. He suggests it. I'm going to ask him why he thought so. the people who run the Reconstructionist place were very happy with my discovery that I'll tell you in a minute. Now, remember, the burning of a book coming so soon after the end of the Holocaust, and so much at odds with the American tradition of freedom of expression, horrified both Jews and non-Jews. Jewish books were burnt not long before that. But the fact that the excommunication and the burning were covered in the New York Times only made matters worse, and everyone assumed, you can read all the literature, everyone assumes that this is sanctioned by Agudas Rabbanim. In writing, in his diary, I'll show you the diary in a few minutes, which was recently published this year, or the years we're talking about, published in 2020, Communings of the Spirit, the Journals of Mordechai M. Kaplan, Volume 3, 1942-1951, Kaplan refers to, quote, rabbinical gangsters who resort to Nazi methods in order to regain their authority. And he later publicly stated as follows, it's just too bad that men who call themselves rabbis should in this day and age resort to the barbarous procedure of outlawing a man without giving him a hearing, and to the Nazi practice of burning books that displease him. God save us from such leadership, and the disgrace it is likely to bring upon Jews. Now, responding to the furor that this created, Agudas Rabbanim made a public declaration that they had nothing to do with the burning. It said that the burning was done independently by someone. And Silver writes that this doesn't make any sense. If you look at the article on Apartheid, which came from Agudas Rabbanim, you see clearly that it was done as part of the ceremony. Silver writes, by saying the burning was not part of the planned activities, Agudas Rabbanim could attempt to refocus public attention on the greater issues of the heresy of Kaplan and the conservative movement, rather than this unsettling thing of burning. He sees it as a face-saving measure. And they too saw that it's a problem. It's a terrible public relations. Everyone's comparing it now to the Nazi burnings of books. And Americans were very troubled by this. And what does he say? That this shows that the Agudas Rabbanim had lost touch with contemporary currents in American culture. And finally, years after the event, Rabbi Norman Lamb wrote as follows. And I agree with Norman Lamb's sentiments, although he's wrong on this particular point, as we'll see. But if we want to win people over to orthodoxy, we need to present ourselves as measured, mature, and moderate people with deep faith and the right practice. But we do not insult others, and we do not damage or condemn them. Sounds like Torah in motion. And Rav Kook used to say that, Ma'at or docha arbe choshech, a little bit of light gets lit. So rather than attacking people, you spread the light, and that by definition will show people the light. Lamb continues, coming out with the Surim against everyone is like another fatwa. When I was younger, there was a heretic by the name of Mordechai Kaplan, and the Agudas Rabbanim had this whole big book burning party. I thought it was ridiculous to have a book burning in the 20th century. It didn't make anybody decide to become more religiously observant. Nobody who was reading his book said, if important Orthodox rabbis burn them, then I'm not going to read them. If anything, it aroused interest in people who otherwise would not have wanted to read these books. But in addition, what it accomplished was it got people to look at the Orthodox as fanatics. That's no way to make friends and win people over to Orthodoxy. So from what we have seen, everyone assumes it's Agudas Rabbanim. And Silver adds, it's unclear who actually burnt the sitter, as the report in Apartheid uses the passive voice. It says the sitter was burnt. However, I tell you now that, in fact, we do know who burnt the sitter. And based on this information, we can determine, or I determined, that the other point that, quote, everyone knows, or everyone except Moskalt, that it was Agudas Rabbanim who burnt it, is incorrect, who sanctioned the burning. And this first point about knowing who burnt it is not something that was only discovered by myself. It's mentioned by David Glinken in his notes to the response of Louis Ginsburg, but I didn't actually see it there. I happened to see it a different way, because in 1945, the Reconstructionist Foundation published a booklet called A Challenge to Freedom of Worship. I don't know why, but this is a very rare publication. I've uploaded it, and I can send it to anyone who's interested in it. From this booklet, you get a sense of the great ill will produced by the excommunication of Kepler. And this is what appears on the first page of the book, of the booklet. It describes what happened, the 200 members of the Augusta Rabbani. Look at paragraph 2. Immediately thereafter, according to the Jewish Morgan Journal, that's the Morgan Journal, of June 13, 1945, a copy of the new heretical prayer book was placed on the speaker's table and burned by the young Rabbi Joseph Ralbag of Congregation Oev Shalom in New York. On June 21st, the New York Times reported that officials of the Orthodox group disavowed responsibility yesterday for burning the new prayer book. They said that Rabbi Joseph H. Ralbag had taken the action without their consent after the meeting. They maintained that Rabbi Ralbag was not even a member of their organization. On the telephone, Rabbi Ralbag denied participating in the burning, claiming, however, that the idea was his and he had proposed it. All admit, however, that no effort was made by those present to prevent the book from being burnt. So Rabbi Ralbag thinks it's a good idea. He suggested it. He's saying that I suggested, you know, if it's written by a heretic, it should be burnt, but he had nothing to do with it. And Agudas Rabbanim say they had nothing to do with it. I looked in the New York Times and I could not find that report there I just read to you. I'm thinking it's a mistake and it's from the Morgan Journal because I searched under Ralbag's name. It comes up a lot, but not there. I saw this booklet before Rabbi Ralbag passed away. And at that time, he was not well. So I wanted to get to the story, get to the bottom of this. After all, this is 1945, and I'll tell you right now. Hold on a second. I spoke to him within the year before his death, I believe. He dies in... he dies in 2011, I think. 2011 or 2010. I can't get the exact date, but I see an article here in 2011 where it says he recently passed away. So something around then. I wanted to get to the story. We're talking 60 years later. 55 years later. 65 years later. Sorry, I want to get to the bottom of this. Because was it a Agudas Rabbanim? Was it independent? What's the choice? I called up his house. First, I spoke to if I'm mistaken, it's his daughter. And she knew the story well. But then I spoke to his son, Rabbi Aryeh Ralbag. And I asked, could I speak? He said, my father's not well. But if you ask, give me the exact questions you want me to ask, and I will ask them. And I gave him the questions, and Rabbi Aryeh Ralbag, he now runs the Triangle K. He asked the exact question, was this, first of all, did you burn it? And was it done independently? Or was this sanctioned by the Agudas Rabbanim? And this is what Rabbi Yosef Ralbag told his son, who told me, then I published it. Now we have the information. We can set to rest for good. There's no reason for speculation or anything else. It came right from the person responsible. First of all, Rabbi Yosef Ralbag did burn it. Why he would deny it to the New York Times or whoever, we can understand why. After all, there were 200 people in the room. They all saw it happen. However, he also said to his son, who told me, this was not a spur-of-the-moment thing. In fact, he knew he was going to do this ahead of time, and he even discussed it with his future wife. The other members of Agudas Rabbanim were unaware of this plan of his. He did not tell them, knowing they probably would say, you can't do it. So we can conclude, there's no doubt this was burnt by Rabbi Ralbag, but it was not Agudas Rabbanim. Agudas Rabbanim was not lying when it said that we didn't do it. The Hapardes article, after the fact, I think they were happy. They looked at it, hey, this is nice, and they put it in the Hapardes article. But that's only b'diavad after the fact. This was not an Agudas Yisrael event, not an Agudas Yisrael action, and it was not part of the official ceremony. Young Rabbi Ralbag, after reading of the Cherem, he then gets up, lights it on fire, and that's exactly what happened. Now, this testimony, which comes from the protagonist, should finally settle the matter. One more interesting point about this is that Rabbi Rav Tzair, Chaim Chernovitz. Oh, we've spoken about Chaim Chernovitz, Rav Tzair, many times. He, very unusual individual, writer of important works. Here he is as a young man. Rav of, when he was Rav of Odessa. He's also a Hebrew writer and a Zionist. But this is also what he looks young. But this is how he looks when he's older. Rav Tzair is one of the only examples I know of a leading rabbi. You know, he's a Rav, he's a posek, he wrote Sfarim, he's open-minded, but he's in the rabbinic world, who gives it all up. He comes to America, he starts teaching at the Jewish Institute of Religion, which is sort of associated with, which becomes later with HUC, but is a non-Orthodox institution. I don't know if he was even a Shomer Shabbos at the end of his life. Ramosha Feinstein, in Masoras Moshe, mentions that Ramosha Feinstein once met him taking a walk. And Ramosha said to him, you know, it's still not too late to do tshuva. Why not return? And the answer, he said something like, it's quoted in Masoras Moshe, like, nah, it's too late. You know, I'm done. But he might have just said it to Ramosha because I don't know if he had any interest in doing tshuva. He continued to write unbelievable works. His works, Toldot HaPoskim, the article in there on the Ketzos, when they did some chidushim, these Haredim in Israel, they just literally lifted Rav Tzair's piece from Toldot HaPoskim and stuck it as the introduction. It's unbelievable work, the Toldot HaPoskim, three volumes, the discussions of the shitot of all the great poskim from the Rambam up until the 19th century. So, but Rav Tzair, he has amazing autobiography. And what a writer. But he also wrote about this issue, and he makes a good point for all the halachic scholars who listen to these, and I know there are many, because you're always sending me things. Please respond to this. Rav Tzair, he wrote a whole booklet on this burning, and he says as follows. I can send it to anyone who wants this as well. On page 4, he says that he calls him Mr. Kaplan, Mark Kaplan. Because I'm Rav Tzair, he's not Orthodox, but he's not a Reconstructionist. He says as follows. He's saying that Kaplan made a mistake when Kaplan was explaining that the rabbis felt, you know, following halacha, that they felt they had to burn his sitters. But he says as follows. He says the sages decreed that a Sefer Torah written by a heretic, you burn it. That's only because the names, the Shemos Hashem, were not written in holiness. And maybe they were written for Avodah Zarah. But in our case, they weren't burning the manuscript of Kaplan. They were burning the Siddur, Shesidero So Yehudi Tamim, which was just put together by a regular Jew. And this Jew, when they put together the Siddur to print it, they didn't have any special kavanas about the names. And therefore, Rav Tzair says it was forbidden to burn that Siddur, because I guess you have to put it in the Geniza, because it has Shemos Hashem. And he says, Uvazeh Sar Rabbinim Shalokadim. And in this, the rabbis didn't do properly Shasarfu et Asidur, that burned the Siddur. And then, as we said, and then he says in parentheses, but they said that they didn't really burn it. Elat Sorba Merabonin Echad, Sarfu Dazatzmo, but Sarfu Dazmo, they said that some young Talmudic scholar decided on his own to burn it. But I don't know, is this the halacha? That we assume you shouldn't burn it because it makes a chilul Hashem, all these other reasons. But according to halacha, is Rav Tzair right that because the sitter was put together to be printed, that is the type was set and the actual printing was done not by a heretic or not by someone, we assume it's by a regular Jew or it could be a non-Jew, that therefore you don't burn it. It's only if it's the actual writing. So that's an interesting point he makes. Because Kaplan was on the faculty of the seminary, it's only to be expected that the Orthodox spotlight shines on Lieberman. In the September 1945, page 31, if anyone wants to look it up, issue of Apardes, the rabbinic journal associated with the Gudas Rabbonim, an open letter is published directed to Harav HaGaon, Rav Shaul Lieberman, Gavra Rabba Ve'ish Eshkolot, the great Rav Shaul Lieberman. It says, Yelamdeinu Harav, you know, Harav HaGaon. By mistake in my Lieberman Kuntras, I wrote Yelamdeinu Rabbeinu. That's not what it says. It says Yelamdeinu Harav HaGaon. That Lieberman, the Rav HaGaon, teach us. Is it permitted to be on the faculty of the seminary together with Kaplan, who is intent on destroying all that's holy? And the letter continues by saying that this question was also a question a few years ago when you joined the seminary. And the rabbis wonder, why is a Kohen, what's a Kohen doing in a cemetery? A Kohen Bevezek Pharos. What's a Kohen, the name we, a great time to argue, doing in a cemetery, namely a place where you're not allowed to be? This has nothing to do with the fact that the Orthodox, as a means of abuse, would call the seminary the cemetery. That was the way they used to refer to it. But Kohen Bevezek Pharos. In fact, in Rabbi Rakefet's autobiography, he recalls that he once saw Ramosha Bick in the seminary, and he asked him the same question. Kohen Bevezek Pharos, and Ramosha Bick replied, if there's an important manuscript here, I shouldn't see it. You recall I told you that story a couple semesters ago. But they asked this question to Lieberman. Why would you teach there? Furthermore, what was a question of what was something to wonder about a few years ago now is a cause for complete shock. How can you, Lieberman, work side by side with Kaplan, who not only desecrates everything that's holy, he's been put in Chayrim? The letter note continues by saying, we have heard that you, Lieberman, you treat Kaplan as if he's excommunicated. But that, the letter says, that's not an answer. That's not a solution. The letter concludes by saying that since we have such respect for the learning and personality of Lieberman, we therefore come with this open letter. Quote, we are concerned for his honor, namely your honor, Lieberman, which is the honor of the Torah. Although it's been 5 years since Lieberman came to the seminary, it's obvious from this letter that he still was regarded as a valued colleague, one to be respected by America's rabbinic elite. This would soon change, though. Lieberman also regarded himself as part of the Orthodox community, as we saw. Now, this report that Lieberman treated Kaplan as excommunicated seems to have been true, at least early on. According to Kaplan, well, let me read it to you. This comes from the 2020 Kaplan, published Kaplan diary on page 260 and 261. He says as follows, he's talking about he describes the Chayrim, and then he says the one who applied the match was a certain Rabbi Ralberg. He didn't know who Rabbi Ralbag was. He calls it B-E-R-G. Then it says, on Wednesday morning at 10:30, I presided over a meeting of the special committee of the Rabbinical Assembly to deal with the problem of enlisting young people for Jewish professional leadership and service. At 1 p.m., I went to Professor Alexander Marx's room in the fourth floor to attend a special luncheon in honor of Finkelstein, whose 50th birthday anniversary had come around. As I entered the room, I noticed that Professor Lieberman did not give the slightest sign of recognizing my presence. I was a bit flustered for a moment, but soon adjusted myself to the situation, because I had always known him to be violently antagonistic to me and my works. At the table later, I noticed that he sat at the very end, together with Davis, referring to Moshe Davis, instead of at a place near the head of the table, according to his status on the faculty. When the luncheon was over and I was waiting for the elevator to take me downstairs, Lieberman was coming in my direction. As soon as he noticed me, he lowered his eyes and hastened his steps. Why are you angry with me? I said in all innocence. I am not angry, he replied and ran on. Later it occurred to me that possibly he regarded it his duty to obey the chayim of the rabbis. Sure enough, when I was at the seminary on Friday, I learned that that was actually the case. So we have evidence that Lieberman, although he's working at the seminary, he decided that the Kaplan's been put in chayim, so he has to hold to the chayim and can't talk to him, can't sit near him, can't do anything like that. That did not last that long, the situation of the chayim, because we know that they had a different relationship within a few months. But there is no public statement of Lieberman against Kaplan then, but in October 1945, there's an open letter to Kaplan signed by Lieberman, Ginsburg, and Alexander Marx. It appears in Hadoar. Hadoar was the Hebrew newspaper. Hadoar really exists until the 80s, I believe. But by then, after like this, the mid-70s, it wasn't the same thing. You had in America, you had a whole American Hebraist culture. Maskilim, and also rabbis. The Rav published, Rabbi Soloveitchik published his famous Hesped for Chaim Heller in Hadoar. You'd have open-minded Orthodox and Maskilim, irreligious Maskilim. And this newspaper, Hadoar, existed for decades. And if you read it, an Israeli would find it very quaint, anachronistic, because it's an old Haskalah Hebrew. And unfortunately, out of all the things online, Hadoar hasn't been put online. And it's so vital. It's so important. Everyone who is anyone. I mean, you pick up Hadoar and you'll see an article, a number of articles by Paltiel Birnbaum. We all know that name. At least anyone under over 40 knows Paltiel Birnbaum. With the name Paltiel, there was a medieval rabbi called Paltiel. We all know that from the Birnbaum Siddur. Young people today, my children would have no clue who Paltiel Birnbaum is. But he was Hebraist. He ran a Hebrew school, like a Hebrew high school. And all these people, Federbusch and Mirsky, and there's a whole Hebraist Hebrew culture. Hillel Bavli, greatest American Hebrew poet, they say. He came from the same town as Rabbi Chiya of Weinberg. He wrote like Westerns, Cowboys and Indians in Hebrew. He taught at the seminary also. So you had a whole, it's great. And they even had that was a weekly. They even had a monthly, Bitzaron also. And this letter was reprinted there as well. The complete letter is not found here, but the sections that, most of the sections are included here. So Alexander Marx is the son-in-law of W.C. Hoffman. He's just a librarian there, never associated with the conservative movement. Obviously, you have Ginsburg and you have Lieberman. And they published this open letter. I don't know what led up to it, why they felt they had to publish it, why they waited till October. There could have been pressure from people involved in the seminary. Because after all, no one likes the book burning, but still, here you have a person on your faculty who's publishing stuff which is against traditional conservative ideology. So they come out with this statement. It's very critical of Kaplan's prayer book. There's all sorts of scholarly critiques, but they do more than that. They say that, first of all, they say that we don't put in Chayrim, because they say today Chayrims don't help. It leads to a desecration of God's name, disgracing the Torah. But they do sharply criticize the Siddur, and they actually conclude, what do you have to do with halacha? You know, these sorts of, what they mean by that is like serious halachic matters. You should stick to Haggadah. It's a play on a Talmudic expression where Rabbi Akiva in the Gemara says, what do you have to do with Haggadah? You should stick to halacha. But in the criticism, it's, although they don't say we're not going to do a chayrim, they say an alarm should have been sounded against the profanation of the sanctities of our people, against the crude abbreviation of the Shema. Can you imagine? Kaplan abbreviates the Shema. We just were talking about abbreviating, you know, getting rid of Yivitan Lachar, maybe Yukum Porkan, but abbreviate the Shema. So that's, this is what Marx, Ginsburg, and Lieberman say. This is the Shema, the recital of which Jewish martyrs gave up their lives for sanctification of God's name. A cry which now reaches our ears from the mouths of martyrs whose blood is yet warm. This is Hebrew, but I'm reading the English. And Kaplan's abbreviating the Shema, dealing with second graders, that you only do the first paragraph or something. There was a need to protest against the changes and omissions of prayer formulas established by our sages, particularly in the Shemona Esrei, which was sanctified by the mouths of our people for thousands of years, even more so against the insipid introduction to the Siddur. The Hebrew term for that is just to that word insipid, how I'm curious as to Chosar Hatam. Okay. He says there was a need to conduct a widespread campaign regarding the tastelessness of the Siddur, which overflows with contradictions and inconsistencies, introducing both pain and laughter. He says that the letter says that in this Siddur, they edited the Book of Psalms to abbreviate and emasculate it. They even amended the Lecha Dodi. So they are just as strong in the criticism of what Kaplan did, but they're not burning it, obviously, and they're not putting anyone in favor, because they don't feel that, he says, for a number of years, we have tried to influence Dr. Kaplan to recant. When he published his new Haggadah for Passover, we protested. We wrote him a private letter and reproved him. And then it goes on that the later act left us no alternative but express our views publicly. Not surprisingly, though, the editor of Apardes thought this sentence, Kaplan, what do you have to do with halacha? They mean halacha in the larger sense of, you know, because well, it is halacha, you know, altering the sitter, things like that. Stick to Agadah. The editor of Aparte says, Kaplan stick to Agadah. Agadah is where you find theological, you know, fundamentals of theology. And the place for Kaplan is nowhere. But at the seminary, Kaplan, I guess they're thinking, you know, Kaplan, he could teach a class on a story of a rabbi. But I really would disagree with them by saying that. Why do I say that? You will see, I'll read it to you now, why even giving Kaplan to read a little bit of Agadah, why it's a problem. Look, Kaplan could have a good way of reading an Agadic story in theory, at least, but the reason I would oppose it for him is because he says as follows about the Agudas Rabbanim. I always had nothing but profound, this is in page 261. I always had nothing but profound contempt for the rabbis associated with the union, Agudas Rabbanim. I had enough of a close view of them to know their immoral dealings. I could not help seeing in them the unfailing demonstration of the low moral level of at least 50% of the Tanaim and Amoraim as reflected in the Talmud. So if Mordechai Kaplan is saying that 50% of the Tanaim and Amoraim are immoral, and these Agudas Rabbanim are following that, then he's not even suitable to give a nice class about the Amoraim of time, an Agadic class. In general, I think someone, even if an observant, could do a nice book on or article on the and teach us a lot about Agadic matters. But if your attitude is, as Kaplan says, that these Tanaim and Amoraim are all immoral, then certainly not. And in general, to say it ends strange. They wanted to end by saying, you know, stick to your own areas. He taught homiletics, that sort of thing. But to mention Agadah is also important. So I see why the editor of Apartheid would have a problem with that. Now, returning to the opening letter of Lieberman, we'll end with this. In the following issue of the journal, there's a short notice in Apartheid. Check out the next issue, in which it states that the Gaon, Rav Shaul Lieberman, had replied to this open letter. Lieberman requested, according to Apartheid, that his letter remain private, so it's not published, with the exception of the last sentence, in which Lieberman requests Rabbi Pardes, or Pardes is the editor of Pardes, to publicize that he has received a letter from Lieberman in which Lieberman attempts to justify his remaining at the seminary. Needless to say, those who are aware of this notice, I never saw it ever referred to. I happened to find it when I was going through in preparation for my Lieberman lecture, going through all the Pardeses. I never saw it ever mentioned. But if anyone would have seen it, they certainly would have wondered what exactly Lieberman said, and any attempts, if there were any attempts to locate this letter, were unsuccessful. I was successful in a great zachus, which I'll just talk, we'll begin next week, in discovering, which as far as I know is the only copy in the world of this, I found the letter of Shaul Lieberman to Agudas Rabbanim, an amazing historical document in which he explains why he's at the seminary, why he's remaining at the seminary, why he felt he could come to the seminary. We will pick up with this next class. And we'll move on with, as always, lots of important material. Let me get to the very learned and interesting comments and questions here. Rabbi Kelman says that there was a major dispute in a large conservative show in Toronto a few years ago of the issue of non-Jews in the choir, and it led to the Chazan leaving and starting another show. You can make the argument that if the non-Jews are good singers, it's pleasant, but it's so inappropriate. Prayers are something, and the cantors are the choir is also involved in prayer. It's not a show. It's not like going to the opera that you're watching someone perform. M.S. Frankel, I believe S&P in New York City has non-Jews in the choir. I do not believe that. I do not believe that at all. If you can find that they do, we have someone from S&P. That's impossible that they have non-Jews today in the choir. I don't know about 50 years ago. Baruch says, in old days, women did not go to show much, if at all, and large shows had galleries, so they were not on the same floor. No, but when I said there's no mention of Machitza Shulchan Aruch, it doesn't even mention putting in the galleries. It doesn't mention keeping separate. You're right. They didn't go to shul. So it was obvious that women wouldn't daven the same place as men. But it is not mentioned. And the fact that it's not mentioned is actually cited by the conservative as pointing out that it's not a problem. Shmuel says about 20 years ago, the same thing happened in a show in Montreal. The board thought a fancy new choir in time for Yom Kippur would help attendance. When it became known that two members of that choir were non-Jews, the rabbi walked out right before Kol Nidre. Tell us, Shmuel, whether you're dealing with an Orthodox shul there or not. David Eisen says that Rabbi Adler's grandson, Joel Benstein, is my neighbor in Beit Shemesh, and Joel's brother, Jeremy, is conservative rabbi, also lives in Israel. Ah, very nice. Rabbi Shudnow says...
It was an Orthodox shul. It was an Orthodox shul. Okay. Yeah. Then Toronto was conservative shul, but the Mencho was an Orthodox shul.
Okay. Rabbi Shudnow says, due to this murder, JTS started a course in the rabbinical school called Pastoral Psychology. This was to train rabbis how to identify serious pathology and refer out. Ah, once again, Rabbi Shudnow enlightens us with a very interesting comment. And David Eisen has a link there to Rabbi Jeremy Benstein's article, My Grandfather's Assassin and Me. I remember reading that article when it came out. Yeah. Pastoral Psychiatry. Yes. And Rabbi Shudnow says he heard the driving tshuva was because of California without a specific Jewish neighborhood. I don't know. Baruch says that Jews as Americans in general then were moving to new areas. There were not old established shuls in those places. New suburbs were new, just converted from farms. Yes, and that was the American people were moving. The Orthodox stayed much longer in their areas. And when they started moving, the Orthodox, many of them were not Shomer Shabbos. And many of the Orthodox shuls in the suburbs, they began with non-Shomer Shabbos, also people driving to shul. But the rabbis never told them it's okay. You try to encourage them, and many of them ended up buying houses and moving closer. But that is absolutely correct. The suburbs were perfectly suited for the growth of conservative Judaism. Susanna says the Sephardim don't have Shafoch either. The great forger, Chaim Bloch, he, in one of his forgeries, he mentions that he found a manuscript of Haggadah that also has a different version of Shafoch. Someone privately texts me that in his Radical American Judaism, Skolk claims that although scholars have naturally assumed that the occasion for the excommunication was Kaplan's 94-day prayer book, it is obvious that the new Haggadah was as important, if not more important, than the prayer book. No, that's not true. Skolk says it, he's wrong. He doesn't know that Skolk says it. It's not true because they did condemn the Haggadah. But if you looked at what I just read, it was Dafka the Siddur that led to the gathering. It was the Siddur that led to the gathering, and the Cherem actually specifically mentions the Siddur. That's what I would say. And someone wants to know, this Rabbi Ralbag, is this Triangle K? Yes, this is Rabbi Ralbag of Triangle K, and the son, who's the former Rav in Amsterdam, who was also always Young Israel of Avenue K, and the father, and the grandfather. There's a grandfather. Rabbi Ralbag's grandfather is a musmach of Yeshivas Rosh Hashanah, I think, in 1918. He dies young. And that's what Rabbi Ralbag today from Triangle K. He went to MTA. Then he went off to, I think, the Mir, or in Israel many years. We spoke about the Ralbag family a couple of semesters ago when the mystery of why Triangle K is, at least in America, is always iffy and questionable. Not in Israel. The Rabbanut HaRashit, you buy products in Israel. It says, sure, the Rabbanut HaRashit, they accept Triangle K. But in America, for whatever reason, I spoke to someone in Ramosha, because Ramosha held to the Triangle K. I spoke to someone in Ramosha's family about why Triangle K is a problem. I don't know, and don't need to get into the discussions. I'll just say one thing, though, that... Rabbi Aryeh Ralbag, with the long black coat and the beard and the Mechaber's firm, I can tell you one thing. He never will be invited to speak at any modern Orthodox shul, although he speaks at the Young Israel Convention, because there'd be a big problem then. If you heard him speak and you saw him, looks like a Talmud Chacham, and with rabbinic figure, you just Google him, you'll see what he looks like. And then as soon as the weekend's done, all the modern Orthodox would say, wait a second, you're telling me we can't trust his kashrus? So it would be a problem. His gittin are accepted by the Rabbanut. His conversions are accepted. Our modern Orthodox rabbis have a problem with conversions. The Agudas Rabbanim, he's the head of the Agudas Rabbanim based in. So I don't know. I've only spoken to him a couple of times, but I thank him very much because he... not only did he help me on this very much, interviewing his father for me, he also sent me, he did work, he upgraded the Eruv in Amsterdam. It's the oldest continuous Eruv. I don't know if it's completely continuous. It might have had a little break like during the war. But the oldest Eruv, it goes back to the Chacham Tzvi. If you look in the Tzitz Eliezer, you see that he did a lot of work in upgrading it. He's a real Talmud Chacham. I asked one of the great poskim of our day. I asked him, I'll hint to it. I had a good story with him in my car, if you recall, from a few semesters ago. And I asked him, so what's doing? Is he Renational, Rabbi Ralbag? He says, I assume he's okay. take it for what you will. Someone privately texts me, the Ravaran Soloveitchik publicly called Chernovitz, referring to his tenure in Odessa, as Avi Avos HaTumah. In Chernovitz, in Odessa, he was the Av Beis Din, and he wrote the tshuva on Erevin there. On the other hand, he did battle with other Dayanim, but his tshuva has haskamas. If you look at it from Big Rabbanim, there was a Rabbi Yeshaya director who was very interested in Erevin, not knowing what became who Chaim Chernovitz was. He reprinted this kuntres on the Erev in Odessa. There were other many Rabbanim who wrote, at least a few Rabbanim wrote haskamas. He was a Maskil. He was a Maskil even when he was rabbi in Odessa, but he was a religious Maskil, and we have plenty of those. But he did, I guess Rav Aharon Soloveitchik is telling us that even during his time in Odessa, you could see the problems there. Someone privately texted me that Rav Chiyaka Weinberg spoke positively of Rav Tzair. That's indeed the case. In the letters that I published, good memory, who texted that to me, to Samuel Atlas, Rabbi Chiyakov Weinberg writes that we're going to put out a safer Jubilee volume for Chaim Chernovitz. And Rabbi Weinberg was asked to contribute, and he writes to Samuel Atlas, of course I'll contribute. We all owe a great debt of gratitude to Rav Tzair for his important works. They never published it, but Baruch says that a printed Siddur doesn't necessarily have shame on certain names of God in the way that a Sefer Torah does, especially the older ones. Correct, and I think you say the Tetragrammaton was not spelled out, rather they use Yud Yud, and I think even if they write, what I would say in response to Chernovitz is perhaps even if you have the Tetragrammaton, it's done by a printing press. So maybe it's different. Someone privately texts me that Louis Ginsberg was asked by Kaufman Kohler, what is a Kohen Bevesik for us when he walked into Temple Emmanuel? Maybe, I don't know. David Eisen says that Nigras Moshe or Moshe notes that one should burn holy works written by an Apikores. He applies this to the writings of conservative former rabbis. That concludes based on Rashi in Gittin. And if they were not written for the purpose of Avodah Zarah, he's not obligated to burn them yet may. So this would be an example. Obviously, it wasn't for Avodah Zarah, but Rabbi Shugno says that Kahati published his Mishnah commentary in Hadoar. Then it was published in book form. No, it was not. It was published in special booklets. If you listen to my talk, which is going to be on the National Library website in another day or two, about Tzvi Yehuda, you'll learn that Tzvi Yehuda was the first collaborator together with Kahati. And in the initial editions of the Kahati, it actually mentions Tzvi Yehuda on the cover page. When it was later published in book form, and I think even in the first edition, it might have had his name, but posthumously today, there'll be no mention. But Tzvi Yehuda, the person who I spoke about, the student of the Chazon Ish, was a contributor. Did Kaplan omit the names of Hashem from the prayers? You know, I can't. I will show you, actually. I have on my computer here. I have a text of a sitter here that I can show you. No, I don't. I can't remember if he. I don't believe he omitted it at all. I don't believe so. I'll get it for next class. His idea of God was the power within us, that sort of thing. But he still used it. You know, he used the name of Hashem. He used the name of God in the current Reconstruction Siddur. They do have it, yeah. But I'll give you a copy. I'll show you a copy next class of the Reconstructionist Siddur. It has the name of God. A couple more. Yes, David points out what I just mentioned. Thank you, David. Bill Gewirtz, the rabbis of the Sinner Synagogue have decided to omit the second chapter of Shema because it makes a reward and punishment too immediate. I recommend everyone, you can read what David writes here about Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda and the Kati. Someone privately says, whatever else is true, the choir at S&P does not daven. I guess you mean that they just, they're singing. Okay. Sprint says, why pressure put on the JTS by Rabbi Lieberman and other JTS faculty? Was there? Was there pressure? I don't know. I don't know what the who put the pressure on. There was pressure. Finkelstein had to respond continuously. What's Lieberman doing here? But not Lieberman. What's Kaplan doing here? But Kaplan had many supporters among the conservative rabbis and among the laity. On the other hand, you had many traditionalists who wanted to know what Kaplan was doing there. And as I mentioned, Finkelstein felt loyalty, it's reported, because Kaplan was his teacher. And also he thought of it as an academic institution, and that what Kaplan does on his own time, that's you don't fire someone for what they do on their own time. Now, rabbinical seminary should be different than a regular academic institution, but Finkelstein didn't think so. So Baruch says Rabbi Yerobog was in Hebron, not near. Rosen says, we'll get to the end. Rabbi Lamb says that the Chayim is wrong because it does nothing to bring alienated Jews closer to Orthodox Judaism, only to separate them from other Jews. But that was precisely what they wanted. As they wrote in Apartheid, they wanted to make the statement to Orthodox Jews that this is not acceptable. Yes, but the point is, first of all, it's going to drive away lots of people. But if Orthodox Jews want to, even the Agudas Rabbani, they want to bring people who are not Orthodox, they want to bring them close, they would agree with that as well. And what Lieber Land was saying is that an action you're doing, you're so foolish, you don't recognize that by this action, you're making it much harder to show Orthodoxy as something appealing. You're helping the conservative movement because people look at you and see you as a fanatic. It's like every year, Agudas Rabbani. I don't think they still do it, but when Rabbi Hollander was alive, every year, Agudas Rabbani, when it was a nothing organization, coming into even the late 80s and 90s, right before Rosh Hashanah, they take out these ads, including in the New York Times, I don't know, Jewish Week, I don't know, the New York Times, they take out these ads saying you should stay home rather than go to a conservative synagogue, even to Kiyas HaShofar. Now, it's true the Rav said that, but the Rav was saying that to Orthodox Jews. He wasn't telling that to non-religious, so maybe that's their only connection, and you're putting this in an ad. So the non-Orthodox Jews read this, this is not making Judaism appealing. So, and privately, and this is the last thing we'll say, someone communicates with me that the Rebbetzin of Rabbi Ralbag, the one whom I told you, he said that he wasn't married to her, he told her that he was going to burn it, but she had to not tell anyone. It was kept secret. The fact that he kept it secret shows that he doesn't think that the Grocer Bunny would have been happy with it. She is still alive, although lately more infirm. She's got to be close to 100 years old now. Thank you very much for that. Again, thank you all for coming out tonight. And take it away, Rabbi Kelman.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we'll look forward to next week. As always, of course, I will remember, if I very briefly, when my brother was the associate rabbi, when J.J. Schechter was the rabbi in the Jewish Center, it was the 75th anniversary of the Jewish Center, which started in 1918. So this was 1993, I believe. And Rabbi J.J. gave a series of lectures on the history of the shul. It was meant as a one-time. It turned out it was about Mordechai Kaplan, as, of course, the it wasn't the founding rabbi, but he was the first rabbi of the Jewish Center. And when he told them he can't become the rabbi because he's not Orthodox, the whole long story is really a fascinating lecture. But when basically they made an agreement with him that what you do in your private life is you do whatever you want. Just you'll conduct an Orthodox service. And he agreed. They voted 14-1, the board, to hire him. They went to the one person to change his vote. You know, it should be unanimous. We can go and tell Rabbi Kaplan that he was hired unanimously, which is exactly what happened. And when they fired him, it had nothing to do with his theology. It had to do with, he was talking about how you have to treat workers properly and the economy, you know, all those, the progressive policies that the wealthy people in the shul didn't go for. Anyway, so it was a fascinating talk, but that's just one aspect.
I thought you were going to say in the introduction book to this book.
I have that book. Yeah, yeah.
The preface JJ gave a great story. Book. Because yeah. In 1976, Yeshiva University wanted to honor their yes. oldest graduate. And right, lo and behold, right. when they determined that it's Mordechai Kaplan, who was the oldest surviving yes. person of Yeshivas Eitz Chaim, they had to put that on hold. They did. They did it again like 10 or 15, 20 years later. But it's a great story. And yeah. Thank you for that.
Rabbi Schechter said he read the 8,000-page diary that Mordechai Kaplan, I assume that's what the book you were showing me yeah. for, but I'm not aware of, was basically said he read through the 8,000 pages. And it was fascinating how he would talk about, you know, the members of a shul. And I mean, just if I can, you know, when he said when they hired, you know, Leo Young, to replace him. So Leo Young from the Hildesheimer Rabbinic Seminary, and Mordechai Avlin was very impressed with him. Said, you know, he's a man, he knows Talmud and Kos, a PhD, everything. But how can such an intelligent man believe in Torah, Mina, Shema? I mean, he doesn't understand how someone so smart can believe in that, you know, ancient stuff. So it's a... So listen, it's an era that we don't have anymore. People, younger people don't have a clue about, you know, whatever. But it was a different America back then. What can we say? Anyways, Yasher Koach, we look forward to next week. Tomorrow, Rachel Danziger-Sharansky continues her series on Genesis, the forming birthplace of human relationships. Rav Carmel Beivrit, as Dr. Mark recommended. Rav Carmel does have some fascinating tshuvot. I have spoken to him privately about some of them. Really quite amazing. About, you know, what we're in the modern state of Israel. And of course, that's his topic, how David HaMelech, that's sort of the base, but it's really discussing issues about modern state of Israel. How do we run a modern state? So it's fascinating. Zebi Vrit, Mishim the Ber Vrit, Avali Vrit, Shalom Ood, Zaloka Shalavina Vrit, Shalom, Bemet, Zani, Then Wednesday night, we're starting, Dr. Sokolow was starting a new series after last year doing a series on the Haftarot on how Tanakh was put together. I sent an email earlier. A lot of people have registered already. So that's going to be this Wednesday night, 8 p.m. David Eisen, if you're still here, that's 3 a.m, a half an hour earlier. I think that's a little harder for you to get up then, but 3 o'clock, 3 a.m. in the morning. And Thursday, as I've been mentioning, Shuli Mishkin will not be giving the shiur this week because her son, thank you, her son is getting married. So we're giving her a week off to celebrate. And she'll be back next week on Thursday night. Rabbi David Blackman from Sydney, Australia, or should I say Friday morning, 10:30 a.m. Friday morning, 8:30 p.m. on the East Coast. The Parsha shiur this week, and I'll be giving my shiur on the Siddur 9:30 a.m. on Friday. That wraps up this week. And then Sunday, of course, Rabbi Liebtag. And Monday morning, we had this morning really fascinating talk. Rabbi Dr. Lindsay Guhartz spoke on Translation Bible. I think a number of you were there today. So she'll continue. That'll be next Monday at 11 a.m. Okay, that's all our shiurim. Keeps busy. Okay. Takes a long time to make the announcements. I'm sorry. Jay, I don't know. Jay, always the other shiurim. But,
Jay, I have a quick
sure.
question.
I'm on our Morocco trip. Dr. Murphy, we were mentioning at the beginning, if those who are up to travel, please God, we're having our third trip to Morocco, the first one, of course, in a long time, and the first one since the Abraham Accords, and it's really, Morocco is a fascinating place, and there's a very active, small, but unbelievably active. There are like 10 minyanim every morning in Casablanca. You go to the street, there are like 7 shuls on one street with minyanim every day, and beautiful kosher restaurants. It's pretty amazing to see. So if for those, that's in January the 3rd, that trip. Okay. Yes. Rashi, what did you want to ask?
Yeah. Do I have to register separately for
anybody who registered for the single registration for all does not have to register again. We send out, you know, you register when, but if you didn't, then we try generally, sometimes, you know, we overlap, but generally anybody registered single, we automatically send them the thing before, but if not, register for the class directly. So if you register for this class, you will not necessarily get a reminder about that class. That's correct. So you do have, it takes literally 20 seconds to register, I think less. You know, just click on the link and just click. Your name should be there. Anybody who's registered before. If you want to make a donation, it takes a little longer, but I'd appreciate that much more.
With Carmel in it, the whole thing didn't work.
Yeah, Rev Carmel is the same thing. Rev Carmel also, you have to register unless you register single for all. If anybody ever wants to come to a class and they didn't get, it sometimes happens, goes to your junk box or I don't know, all kinds of things with mass emails. Things happen. People don't get them. You can just use, it's the same login as I'm sure you figured out. We want to make it easy. It's important to have regular the registration, but it's the same login. So, you can just go in Wednesday at 1:10, 1:14 to come in for Rev Carmel, the same fall 2021. But, and if you don't get, let us know. You're right. But I know people sometimes they don't get the,
I'm going to have to listen to him on the YouTube.
Yeah. Listen on YouTube. That's fine. Or whatever. Yeah. Okay. Laila Tov, anybody? The Abraham Accords in Morocco. Yeah, I don't know. Could be. We'll have to see. We were there before. We were there in the summer of 2019. That was our last trip. We had to Morocco. The last trip Torah Motion did was in January 2020 to Morocco. Just before the world was turned upside down. So please God, the world will be getting back slowly to normal or fastly to normal. And please God, people should be well and healthy. That's the most important thing. But anyway, so that'll be the first trip. And please God, we can travel again in the summer and, whatever. Okay, everybody. Laila Tov. Thank you. Don't forget to invite a friend to come to one of the classes. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Bye-bye. Yeah. Dr. Eisen, David Eisen, thank you. By the way, I also remember reading that article when it came up, but I just reread it. A very sad article. Imagine a guy killing a rabbi in shul on Shabbos morning. I can imagine being there. Wow. How tragic. Okay. COVID matzav in Toronto right now is, we have 300 and something cases today in Ontario. We're generally being under 500K, around 500K. There are 15 million people in Ontario. So we've been having for the last month, four to a bad day, 600 cases or so. So, and most, our vaccination rate's about 87%, I think, one dose, and the 82%, two doses is pretty high. And, I mean, unfortunately, people are still dying, but not so many. I mean, less than they, were before. We have about 28,000 deaths in Canada for a population of 37 million people. So compared to the States, which is 10 times as much, but they've got, way more than 280 comparisons. So relatively speaking, Canada is doing well, but if anybody's sick, that's not good. That's not good. Restrictions relaxed a little bit. Yeah, they let in everybody who wants to go to see the Maple Leafs play. They don't have any restrictions. I don't know why. Restaurants are masking indoors. You have to wear a mask indoor. And a lot of vaccine mandates, Baruch Hashem. A lot of places you can't get in without your proof of vaccine, including the hockey game. But they did open up the arena to be whoever wants to go. I don't know, whatever they had, 20,000 people. I'm not sure what they had at the opening game for the Leafs. But restaurants are still restricted. It's very strange that some things don't make sense. Whereas you can't eat at a restaurant unless you're 2 meters apart and whatever. Okay, I don't know who's listening, but Baruch, I figured I'd answer your question on the restrictions relax. So whatever, our school chat where I teach 1,200 kids walk around everybody all day wearing masks. Even though every kid in the school is vaccinated, I think, unless there's some medical exception, but there's a vaccine policy. No teacher or student is allowed in the school without a vaccine. And we all wear masks. So that's to keep it more careful. So, hockey players. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I wasn't talking about those masks. I don't know. They're supposed to wear masks. I think the fans are supposed to. I have no idea what they're doing. I haven't watched any of the games yet. Hockey season just started, so I don't really know. But, it doesn't pay to watch the Leafs. They just disappoint you every year. But as any Toronto hockey fan would know. All right. I'm talking too much. Laila Tov, everybody. Be well. Thank you.